It's said that when you have a baby, there's a dozen books that you can read that are going to help you with every stage of development from pregnancy through, gosh, well into childhood and adolescence. There really is not a lot of resources and guidebooks for what it is to watch a parent age and what happens to their body and what happens to their mind as we're witnessing that aging process. Today's episode, I'm talking to a professional who's in that space, someone who is focused on the bodies and health of older folks every single day and has built an entire organization around people who do the same thing for people in their community. I also want to point out that because this is a medical professional, Surfing the Quicksand is purely media and entertainment, so nothing that my guest today, Dr. Katie Wadland, should be considered to be medical advice because she's not your doctor. Welcome to Surfing the Quicksand. Have you been hearing me talk about the Clever Girl Organizing Challenge and wondering if 2026 is your year to join? Well, now's your chance to find out. Registration is now open through January 4th, 2026. We spend 11 weeks together, and I give you an assignment every week. We're going to work on all the spaces and categories in your home that are kind of causing some chaos. Your kitchen, paperwork, clothes, kids' toys, all the different spaces that really can get out of control, whether it's around clutter or your systems, and you just feel overwhelmed and don't know where to start. You're going to start with me. You'll be part of an 11-week program with weekly assignments, an exclusive supportive Facebook group community where I give you much more content on helping us understand and getting to the bottom of what you own, why you own it, and where you keep the keepers. I'm all about helping you understand the psychological and emotional barriers that have been getting in your way and helping you figure out ways to tackle that. Head over to clevergirlorganizing.com for you to find out more about the 2026 Clever Girl Organizing Challenge and sign up by January 4th. See you there. One thing a lot of midlife women have in common these days is many of us are still caring for our aging parents and loved ones and doing it as fiercely as we can. And in that process, we're watching their bodies betray them, right? As they're getting older through normal, healthy aging process or through falls, through injuries, through surgery recovery, through medical and neurological diseases, they are getting a bit weaker all the time. And it starts sometimes with, gee, mom's not so steady on her feet anymore. Mom needs a cane. Oh, we're getting mom a walker. Oh, we're getting the big walker. Mom needs a wheelchair. Mom's in bed. She doesn't get out much anymore. Right. And really being able to see that progression happen sometimes right before our eyes. It was really important to me to bring in somebody who could talk to us about what that looks like and feels like from a professional point of view by bringing in somebody who is focused on physical therapy and occupational therapy from a geriatric point of view. I have someone I'm introducing you today who not only focuses on that in her business, but also a fair amount in her personal life, and we're going to talk about that. Katie Wadland, Dr. Katie Wadland, is a doctor of physical therapy and a board-certified geriatric clinical specialist. And in 2020, early COVID days, she recognized that she needed to make a big change for her life and for her profession, and she launched her own practice, which in July 2020 was one person, and today is 23 people that work for her and help deliver her Medicare B provided and supported geriatric care for seniors that help them recover, rehabilitate, and preserve the strength that they have, and whenever possible, prevent things from getting worse. She's committed to community education, not only from webinars on fall prevention and balance, but also strength and training and balance classes where she's helping people every day do the work to help preserve the strength that they have and their abilities. I'm so excited to introduce you to Katie. And by the way, she's a neighbor of mine in the North Shore, Massachusetts area. So if you're getting excited that she's someone and you're in Massachusetts and this might be somebody that you could bring in to help your loved one with at-home physical therapy, you're going to want to tune in to every last word. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you for having me. And I'm so excited to talk to you.
I reached out to you early on when I was thinking about just kind of like that full wheel of everything that midlife women, especially those of us who still do have our parents around or those senior loved ones that are prominent in our lives, because this is just kind of inevitable, right? Eventually, the care that our older folks need is going to increase, whether that's, hey, it's knee surgery and a hip surgery, and that's just normal and PT goes along with that, or there are falls, or there are illnesses, or there's a nursing home stay, or there's a pneumonia they never really recover from. All of these things eventually comes with the doctor saying, hey, I'm going to prescribe you some prescription for PT. I know I deal with this a lot with my parents. And quite frankly, in my mid-50s, I'm probably not so far from knocking on that door myself, right? So at some point in time, and I am working on my balance and I am working on my own flexibility, thinking about my own healthy aging, right? Your business, healthy aging, mm-hmm. physical therapy is not just for the old folks, it's for us too.
Right.
And so I want to talk about today we're going to talk about what you've built. I want to start with talking about why you built it, right? Because I don't think that I hear of a lot of physical therapists who say, I'm just going to do this on my own. Tell
Sure.
me about how that started.
Well, I will save you a lot of effort in that it wasn't a plan. This wasn't something I thought about for very long and thought, you know, there's a real need. I'm going to jump out there and fill that gap. That was definitely not the course I took. I was working at a home health agency through a big hospital in Boston during COVID. I had been there for about 8 years at the time, and I loved it. I was very happy. I never had aspirations of being in charge. I never had aspirations of being a practice owner. I probably would have retired there should life's not taken the turns it took. But I was working in early COVID, and they had furloughed most of the staff at this time, and I was a senior staff, so I was still working. But I had kids. My kids were in kindergarten and third grade at the time, and they don't really Zoom that well on their own, so I had to take some time to kind of shuffle my schedule. So I was in, you know, early COVID, working Saturday, Sunday, and Wednesdays, kind of homeschooling the other days. My husband, we were just balancing things as best we possibly could. And then because I was one of the remaining staff, they wanted me to start 9 to 5 Monday through Friday again. And I couldn't. I mean, I just couldn't be in two places at once. So I took the family leave that was offered at that point to be with the kids, to deal with that stuff at home. I was there for, I mean, 14 weeks I took the leave. And I remember standing in my kitchen, just feeling so not lost, but like, I can't do this. I can't be home full time. And not just because for me, mental health wise, I like working, but I felt really guilty that I wasn't out helping the world right now because so many of my colleagues were working in like the tent hospitals and just doing all the things that people were doing at the time that was really heroic. And I felt like I had to do something. Right. And I talked to my husband about volunteering and going to work in the units. He was really concerned about it, you know, and he really said to me, well, do you want to put the kids at risk? And no, of course I don't. So I was able to pretty quickly figure out, okay, well, what I can do is still see patients in a safe way at home, open up my own, you know, one person show, basically. I didn't know how. I talked to some friends who were already doing it, quickly put together a game plan. And it was as simple as that. So by July, I was back and working. I was able to make my own schedule so I could still be with the kids, work when I could work, and, you know, really had the flexibility. And yeah, so I think I met you probably around then, Kathy. We were in a networking group together. So you saw me going from, you know, doe in the headlights, confused, to trying to figure out then, once I got full, how to hire somebody else. So within 3 weeks, I was totally full. And our roles had kind of flipped at home where I was now working full time. I was out of the house 9 to 5 after all anyway. And my husband was really managing the home side of things with the kids because he was now working remotely. And literally the story just repeated itself. I would fill, I would hire, I would fill, I would hire. We would just kept going and going and going based on need. And it was never that I thought, hey, this is my plan to have this giant practice and, help all the geriatric folks in the world. But it became that over time. Once I started seeing the impact we were having at this level, I started to feel more fuel and really think, hey, this is really needed. People can't get to other clinics. And at the time, clinics were closed. I mean, it was a moot point. No one could go to a clinic. So the people in the hospitals were tapped out, the home health were overworked. And then the outpatient clinics, which was the next reasonable step for people typically, were closed. So people just weren't getting care. So it was a lot of right place, right time, and some good instincts and some good guidance that led me to where it is now. And a lot of me chasing something and letting sort of fate drive the course and following things where they went, and learning along the way, going from a PT with an idea to a PT with learned experience in business management to a PT who actually went back to a school program to learn about business when I realized I actually needed to know what I was doing when it started to really grow further, to now feeling like I'm actually a business person. I'm an entrepreneur who has a practice. I practice my therapy craft as well. But my self, perception has changed significantly along this process.
It's so amazing to kind of hear, because 5 years is not a long time to
No.
completely redefine not only your relationship to your profession and your craft, but your self-identity around who you are as kind of as a woman, as a member of a household, as a manager. I love hearing that you're like, oh gosh, I have to go back to school, right? So that part of saying I'm go, right? I heard you say we filled, we hired, right? You kept growing to be able to say, well, if I don't stop, things are going to get off the rails. I need to stop and take a step back and be thoughtful about the way in which I grow with intention.
Absolutely. And I hit that probably at year three, where it really felt unmanageable and borderline out of control. So I'd get that peak where we'd hire a bunch of people and then it would feel really out of control for a while. And around year three, I was working, 60, 80 hours a week. And it really, I had to sort of sit down and do some thinking about how am I going to scale this and make it into a reproducible model that it's not just me teaching someone one-to-one each time, because you can only do that so many times. If you're going to grow, you have to actually put systems in place that you can educate someone else on implementing. Otherwise, it revolves around you. And when you grow to a certain point, it can no longer revolve around you. It has to revolve around the practice. And that was a transition point for us. So when I started to really see that, take the time to start saying no, to certain things. At the beginning, it was all about yes, right? Who can I meet with? Yes. What can I take on? Yes. But then it got to a certain point where that's no longer benefiting anybody. It has to be no, let's focus inward. Let's focus on development of these, SOPs and policies and procedures and handbooks. So it's not always me teaching and that it can help more people that way. So again, it also starts as like, what can I do physically to help someone? To what can I set up so I can physically help more people exponentially? So that changes when you grow a practice and when you grow a business.
I think the fact that you were able to do that by year three is tremendous, because I think a
Well, I
lot
wasn't done. I
no,
started at three. That's when I realized there's a problem.
but really, but the idea of saying being able to look around and say, oh, th we've got it's gotten to that point where I need to do that, because I think a lot of people will let things go longer. They'll say, no, I have this. No, it'll be easier. One more month, one more 6 month period. It'll be better. It'll be better, without really making that intervention to make an important change.
Absolutely.
I want to talk about the idea of how the kind of the services that you do, right? The services that you do, but so the services that your firm does. So I want people to start get a better understanding of what it is when we're talking about kind of home health-based physical therapy and the work that you do.
Yeah, I think it helps to see it in the continuum. So as you mentioned, as we get older, all sort of stuff happens. There's natural decline, there's more accidents and injuries and illnesses and hospital stays and bumps in the road. So, typically someone who's older, has something happen, you or I can maybe bounce back, but they don't bounce back. So they end up in the hospital. They come home from the hospital, they have a VNA, a typical visiting nurse association, and that goes through Medicare Part A. So the VNA sees someone for usually 30 to 60 days at the high end, and typically they focus on bringing that patient back to a baseline, but it may not address all the things that are going on that have led to that place, right? So there may still be balance impairments and strength impairments and Parkinson's and dementia, kind of underlying conditions that aren't adequately managed. So typically, Med A therapy is limited in scope and time. And once they hit that max, they say, okay, you should go to an outpatient clinic, go to Spalding, go to Bay State, go to AMPT, whatever the local practice is. Oftentimes, as you well know, Kathy, I know patients then can't actually get to the clinic, right? Whether it's limitations of driving or mobility, or they have cardiac conditions that just getting out of the house is exhausting. By the time they get to the clinic, the therapy is not that effective. So what we do is we are a clinic that comes to you. So we're Medicare Part B, just like any other outpatient clinic is, but we bring the therapy to the patient's home or ALF or independent living like Brightview. And we provide therapy there. So we provide physical therapy, occupational therapy, and in the last 2 years, we've really focused on developing our wellness options. So Wellness 365 is our cash-based part of our practice, and we provide private therapy for ongoing therapy if they want to go beyond what insurance covers. And we also have personal trainers that work with us and do personal training. So that's kind of the scope of our in-home services. Beyond that, we also, like you mentioned, do a lot of community education. We teach in local senior centers, both as a point of marketing for one, of course, but also giving back to the community, being a place where our patients can continue to work with us in a group setting, and just improving public health overall. So we've got a lot of different things going on in our practice, but that's really the bulk of it. And we specialize in working with older adults, folks with Parkinson's, and people with complex medical issues, just by nature of those are the folks who really struggle to get to that next place in the continuum.
Yeah, I really appreciated your sense of sometimes just leaving the house and getting to therapy is all that a person can do, right? That's very relatable as I can think about people in my own life where you're like, gosh, by the time you get to physical therapy, you can't do any of that work. So being able to cut all of that out and use the energy that's there is a tremendous boon. I want to ask about what the difference is between physical therapy and occupational therapy. Can you walk through that?
Absolutely. And it's a common area of confusion. And some people say arms versus legs, right? That's a common way to look at it, right? PTs work with leg strength, OTs work with arm strength, but it's not quite that cut and dry. So physical therapists tend to work on pain management often. That's kind of your typical ortho clinic, right? We're working on knee pain and back pain and shoulder pain. But really, we're working on mobility, functional mobility. Can you get from point A to point B? How does the walking look? Have you had falls? We're working on that sort of thing, regaining function after traumatic injuries, strokes, brain injuries, spinal cord. So we're looking at big motor patterns. OTs tend to work more on fine motor control. So they do more hands, but that's because the hands are involved in fine motor control. So they're involved in self-care tasks and grooming and bathing, and they're doing more functional mobility in the sense of how it helps you take care of yourself and your home and participate in both avocational activities and vocational activities. So leisure activities, work-related activities. And there's OTs who also specialize really more in cognitive therapy. So they focus more on like dementia management strategies and recall and kind of compensating for deficits that we may not be able to repair, but we can compensate through technology or other environmental modifications.
Really complex. And I do like the kind of legs versus arms starting point, but understanding it's kind of like the kind of the gross motor versus most of the fine motor and really understanding it's the occupational therapy is occupation being kind of a gee work or job. But for some people the work is, can you get dressed? Can you brush your teeth? Can you prepare dinner? Can you, right, do the things that help you get through your life in the way that you hope to?
Yep. And there's overlap. It's not 100% black and white. There's overlap. And one thing I love about our team is we collaborate. We're always collaborating, right? If you have a PT and OT working with you, they're talking all the time about how to best help you, how to use the same strategies or reinforcing the same things. And even if you don't have an OT working with you, we're talking to them anyway. We're getting ideas, we're bouncing things off each other. So it's a pretty integrated partnership between the PTs and OTs.
When you start to work with someone, what does that look like? You get a phone call from somebody who says, "Hey, Medicare just stopped paying for what was covered. They said I should go get a referral to go work with somebody else. I heard you're great. How do we get started?"
Yeah, so I mean, from the logistical aspect, we're doing an intake, right? We have a wonderful office manager. She calls you or calls the patient directly, depending on who's doing the intake, does all the insurance verification, all that sort of stuff, schedule an appointment, right? That's the pretty basics. Once we see you for an evaluation, your therapist's job is to identify areas that we can address through intervention that are going to either improve your safety, your quality of life, or your mobility. And usually it's a mix of everything combined, right? And sometimes, we look at therapy in two approaches. What can we rehabilitate and what can we or do we need to compensate for? So there's some aspects of people's decline that we can improve, right? Cut and dry, you break your hip, we can strengthen your hip, get you back to walking. Great. Other things we can't necessarily expect you to improve, especially when you have something like Parkinson's. We can improve your balance, mobility, and walking to some degree, but we can't get rid of the Parkinson's. So, what are we compensating for in that setting to really make sure that you're safe? It may be getting the right device, the right walker, the right wheelchair. It might be educating you and your family on what we suggest for ultimate safety at home. It might be putting in some referrals to elder services, right? We're always thinking about what can we layer in to support. And this is something I think more unique to our practice because we see it. It's one thing to go to a clinic and you present with what you present with, right? I walked in the door, I use a walker. My balance is this. When you're in home with someone, we're seeing reality that doesn't always get transcribed appropriately or adequately in a clinic setting. So we're seeing the near falls answering the door. We're seeing the areas in the home where we think could be a problem down the road. So there's a little more holistic approach because we're trying to not only help you restore your function, but also look at how you're living and how your care is, and how can we maximize that area to make sure you're living as well as you can.
I know as a professional organizer who often works with older people, I have, an eye always towards the what's going on in here that looks like a trip risk, a fall risk. What do you mean you have to climb over that chair to open up the window? Like, I'm always looking at that because I think someone's environment and their stuff, and even if it's just a like what most people just consider a garden variety amount of stuff, forget about more of a hoarding situation or something like that. It is something I'm always talking to my clients about. And I have a client in mind who lives in an older home here in my town, and older homes can be really funky. And her bedroom is upstairs, and I'm confident the stairs to get upstairs are not to code right there. There's like I have small feet, and my feet don't fit on the stairs. And every time I talk, I'm like, "What can we do? You've got two bedrooms on your main floor. What could we do to get you comfortable?" To shift your living situation so that you're living on one floor. You can't, right? No one else is on the house. What are some things that we can think about? Because I see that's like one bad Thursday away from a devastating story.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, and it's both pieces, right? You're in the court of the in the compensation area, right? What can we compensate? What can we change in the home? And I'm looking too, like how can we get your strength better so you can use the stairs or change how you're climbing the stairs? Victorian houses are fascinating and horrifying. They're like the most non-straightforward flight of stairs you can imagine. And I just picture PTs and other settings teaching their patients, here's the four stairs with the two railings with the tread markings. And then home health PTs walk in and go, yep, no, it's a curved flight of stairs. It's missing treads and the bathroom. The only bathroom in the home is on the second floor, right? There's realities that you see in home that it's really it's a fun part of our job. because it's very much in the moment problem solving. And it's using whatever resources you can pull together. There's no aides, there's no one to come help you get bailed out if you're stuck on the stairs with someone. You have to really be creative and use good judgment and think outside the box, which for someone who likes that is it's a great position to work in. And I like that. I like the challenge of it.
So when you're working with a patient, I think of the term compliance, right? Patient compliance is a phrase I know, which essentially is a nice way to say, are they doing the things we said they should do? Are they doing the things they said they would do? Whether that's, practicing on their own or working through it there. How do you coach, or how do you look for that and help to reinforce how patients continue to support themselves when you're not in the room with them?
I think there's two parts of that. One is making sure you're addressing the same goals that your patient has, right? If I'm trying to get someone to do something that they have no desire for the outcome, there's not going to be compliance, and why would they, right? The other part is really meeting them where they are. What are you ready to change? What can you change? And how are we going to get to that next step? So I think that the historic approach of therapy and giving, here's your 10 exercises on this piece of paper with these stick figures, do them every day. I'll ask you on Friday if you did them, is really useless. So I think it really needs to be a joint effort on determining goals that are both relevant to the patient and meaningful in a physical change way. And then using different techniques to choose activities that are salient and not just a whole bunch of basic, bend your knees this way, flex your feet this way exercises. So we try to focus on function, right? If someone's struggling with getting off the toilet, the exercise program are sit to stands, right? We're not going to do ankle sets because that's not going to help you get off the toilet. We're doing things that are going to help you stand up from the toilet. So it's really, really focused on meeting the goals they have and also using strategies that get people involved in caring for themselves in a different way than they're probably used to with therapy.
It's so interesting to talk about the goals, and what comes to mind for me is lots of people may not say, oh, my goal is to be able to get off the toilet, right? Like that doesn't sound like a dream that people are setting about, but for a lot of people, that's kind of where they have to start. I'm thinking about a situation. My dad had gone through some physical therapy a few years ago, and I remember him sharing that the therapist asked him if he had any goals, and he was like, no, not really. And he wasn't in a get off the toilet kind of situation there, but he struggles with his mobility. And I remember him saying, oh, I thought of a goal. I really want to be able to go out onto my balcony and be able to go water my plants. You're like, oh, okay, that's a complex move, right? That's get up on your walker, it's open the door, keep the door open as long as you can, be able to pivot and turn and move to where the plants are, sit comfortably, get the water bottle, right? A lot of room. So even when you say, I have a goal, there's a whole slew of mechanics that can be involved with achieving that goal.
And one thing too is asking about the why. So here's a common scenario. We see someone who comes to us because we have the reputation of being a Hail Mary sometimes, like, oh, healthy aging can help. And everyone said no, I've gotten turned away, no one else can do anything. Let's go to healthy aging. So we get people who haven't been out of bed in 4 years or haven't walked in 2 years, and their goal is walking. And sometimes I have to be the, recenter conversation and say, well, why do you want to walk? Obviously, there's, some easy answers, but usually it's to restore independence. It's usually, I don't want to have to ask my loved one for help. I want to be able to get to the senior center and play poker again. It's something else, right? The walking itself is sort of inconsequential. So when I try to figure out the why, then we can work around and have a better conversation. Okay, we should work on walking, but in reality, we might get you walking in the house with help, but that's not going to get you to the senior center. You know what would? A good power wheelchair. Right. So then we can have that conversation in a more productive way than you can't walk. It's not going to happen. I'm going to order a wheelchair. So when you get at people's why, you can really develop more appropriate game plans for people, and then they're more invested. And we don't ever write off people's personal goals, right? If your dream is to walk, we're going to try and walk. I'm not going to say, no, it's not possible. We're going to try it and we're going to work on it. but we're going to also reorient to what's the most direct route and the safest route to get you to your actual goal, which is something typically more quality of life based or independent based or something to that nature.
Katie, I'm reminded of earlier in the conversation where you talked about creativity, right? And what you just described feels like the perfect example of where sometimes you need to be creative, which is not about, it's about understanding what is it we're trying to do here. And the path that that patient or that patient's family thinks is how you get from A to Z. Whereas, like, hey, listen, guys, we can actually get to Z in some other ways. It may mean a compromise, it may mean spending money, it may mean feeling like you're giving up on some things or feeling like a failure, and there's some emotional barriers that go along with that. But if we all understand and we all agree that the goal is, can we get back to playing poker in the senior center? Like, what are the many different pathways we can get to that that don't rely on just, oh, I'm gonna walk there?
And that's something I've learned with experience and age, and I feel like when I first started to be a therapist, I was like, what can I fix? What can I rehabilitate? Right? I know all about neuroplasticity. And if we do this thing 1,000 times, it's going to heal the brain. And as I've gotten wiser and older a little bit, I start to see there's so many other aspects to a human besides their physical capacity, right? There's realities, there's help, there's what's the support like? What's the other social, emotional characteristics that are impeding this patient, right? They might have the strength, but do they have the motivation? Are they anxious? Do they have other preconceived notions about therapy that's interfered before? So it's just a really wide range of reasons why patients are or are not successful. And to be effective in therapy, we have to address those and not just take this pigeon-viewed look at, you have potential. Let's do all these things to get you there. And it's a learned experience, I think, over time and seeing lots of different pathways and lots of different directions and lots of different patients.
I like this as a segue into talking about the family, right? As, again, let's talk about the adult children, the people who are probably listening to this, because it's really easy for someone to just say, "Mom, why aren't you working hard enough? They gave you the exercises. Why aren't you doing this?" Or hearing the excuses like, "Well, I didn't like that person," or, "Well, they came and I was too tired, so I couldn't work." The things that come up with this. Can we talk a bit about how you interact with that family support, not only during an engagement, right? But also when you're talking with the family before you start, what do you want them to hear? What do you need to hear from them?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of our intake. We sit down with each patient. We're talking for about half an hour before I even have them do anything, which again, very unusual. Most practices, you talk for 5 minutes and then they're going through the paces. And one of the questions we always ask are, who's in your circle? Who are your caregivers? Who is living in your home? Who do you speak with on a regular basis? So we start to see the picture of who's involved in this patient's life. And then once we get to know that caregiver, adult child, loved one, whatever it may be, we're looking at them just like we look at our patients in what capacity did they have? What are their barriers? What are they able and willing to do? Because again, if I tell them a litany of things they have to do with their loved one each day, but they're me and they run a business and they have 2 kids and they have a podcast to record on, Wednesday, it's not realistic to have them do that. So knowing where they're coming from before you start to bark commands is going to be the key to really getting what you want, which is help for your patient. And so then again, we're layering in support. Okay, if you're able to commit to walking with them once at night when you come home from work, great. But really, they need to do something during the day. So can I give you some resources for hiring a home health aide that can come in? We'll train the home health aide how to do the home exercises. They need more supervision. I know you can't be there 24/7. Here's what I'd suggest for maximizing the safety at home. There's the kind of Ring style camera doorbells, there's the home safety monitoring, there's Alexa, there's all sorts of devices we can kind of put in home for a little more security. Or there's this patient's not safe by themselves, they need to have somebody with them all the time. So we're the people who identify the level of need and then try and figure out with the family what can they do, what can't they do, and what can we guide them in terms of getting more support for the areas they can't Help them, because you can't ask people to do the impossible. We all have busy lives. So it's really figuring that out first before we start asking more of people, because they're already doing an awful lot.
I love hearing that approach, both the we spend a half hour with the patient in the first place, but really kind of thinking more broadly about what that support system looks like before you can even say, hey, if you want to be successful, you got to tell your daughter that when she comes home from work, she has to do this, this, and this for you. Otherwise, you won't gain the traction that you want, right? And setting up
Right.
a really adversarial situation there, it can be really tough. And I think about something that comes to mind is if I think about some folks I've connected with, like they're not always so honest with their medical practitioners about what they can do, what they can't do, what they are doing, what they aren't doing. And I think
Right.
that's a role I think sometimes that I think the adult child or the loved one can come in and to say, yeah, mom, I know you told Katie that you still go to the mailbox to get the mail, but honestly, I don't think I've seen you do that in about 6 months. And it's not even that they're lying in some cases. They just don't think that that part of their life has ended, right? They still absolutely think they're capable of it. So of course they would say it in the present tense. Is that part of the phenomenon that you see when you're trying to get, whether it's the intake or the ongoing support to say, all right, what's really
Yes,
going on?
of course. And there's all different reasons, right? Some is cognitive and memory, and some is insight, and some is denial, and some is not wanting someone to know that they're not functioning the way they have been. And a lot of it is not trying to make their loved ones feel like they have to do more, right? They don't want to put pressure on someone to help them. And if they know that they're having more falls, then there's going to be that pressure. One thing I often talk with my patients and caregivers, especially if there's a caregiver in the room, is I start the conversation by saying, and even if someone doesn't interact with me, even if someone has dementia and they can't give me the back and forth, I always say, I'm going to speak to the patient. You're in the room and I want you to listen, and you can both feel free to tell me whatever you want. And that way the patient feels like they can give the representation of themselves they want to, and they're not being overridden by the other voice in the room. But that the person in the room also knows that I'm listening. So I'm looking eye to eye with my patient, but my ears are open, and anything they're going to contribute to the conversation, I'm taking in consideration as well. So all the voices in the room are heard, and between that you get an accurate picture.
Now, you just mentioned dementia in a patient, and I know you have deep expertise in Parkinson's and some of the other cognitive issues we've talked about, right? Well, more complex than broke a hip, had a fall, right? Can you talk a little bit about what treatment looks like when you're working with somebody with dementia, or you're looking with somebody who's Parkinson's, and yesterday is always better than today is?
Yeah, it's a very different approach. When someone has dementia, we can't expect the recall to be the same as if I told you someone else about, this is how you care for yourself. So repetition is key and familiarity is key. And really simplifying, but keeping things focused on the functional goals again. It's not that to do the same exact exercises every single time, but I typically keep the structure of the session the same, right? I come in, I say hello, we sit down, we do something together, we stand up, we do something together, we take a walk. So I sort of recommend people adapt a similar structure to their exercise sessions or their activities in general. So it feels very familiar. Routine matters. So the biggest question I get from loved ones is, well, they won't do this with me. They only do it with you. How do I get them to do the program with me? And I really encourage making it part of the day. And it's like they have the breakfast, you put the shoes next to them. Breakfast is over, shoes go on, we take the walk. And it's not so much a, hey, are you in the mood for your exercises that the PT gave us? It's okay, let's go for the walk today. And it becomes rote because you're doing it over and over again in the same pattern. So that's how people with dementia or memory impairments tend to learn better, is by repetition, routine, and again, the salience piece. We may not get someone with dementia to do the same exact exercises as somebody else, but if they can get up and do a walk through the garden and bend over to pick up some weeds because they've been a gardener for 50 years, that's going to be more important and more effective than having to do something else.
It's so great to hear that, like even that small tip, because I know people are frustrated saying, just like you said, gee, she won't do it with me. And the frustration of working with somebody whose cognitive abilities you just really can't count on them saying, we did this yesterday, of course you can do it today. So the idea of being able to put it into routine first and foremost as your biggest asset, I really like this hit. I want to shift, if we can, to your personal story, because you have been and are like you are an adult child who is dealing with supporting a parent, and you are, as you said, an entrepreneur and a mom, and got a puppy in the room, all those things. You've got a long time. Can we talk about your personal journey here that's going on at the same time?
I'm very transparent. I'm 43 years old. My mom has actually had Parkinson's since she was 42, which I realized a few weeks ago. Oh my gosh, that was a year younger than I was. So to some degree, I've been involved in her caregiving since that time. So I was in my early 20s. I was in PT school. She got diagnosed. So we've learned together. And of course, she lived independently on her own for a very long time. And it was mostly support, emotional support, kind of planning for the future stuff. But in the last 10 years, it's been more involved. There's been periods where, she's lived with us, periods where I've helped her in her own homes, in different, Brooksby Village, that sort of setting. So there's always been that component. She's single, so there's also no one in the home with her. So my sister and I are pretty involved in her day-to-day routines. And I have kids. They are teenagers. I have two teenage girls. We have a new puppy. And it's always a balancing act. And I always describe it as feeling like an octopus with eight arms. Like there's always somebody pulling one arm or two arms at the same time. And I'm in the middle just trying to take care of myself a little bit here and there, but mostly feeling like I'm being pulled in a lot of directions. And they're all important directions, right? I'm not doing anything superfluous that I think is not important. I'm doing things that are important in each of these different directions, whether it's work, my patients, my mom, my dog, my husband, the kids, right? There's always something. But they're all valuable and they all need my attention. So, my default stress is feeling like I'm not giving enough to any one of those arms at one given time. And then defaulting to not caring for myself enough because that's the last thing on the list. So I've had to get better about trying to prioritize the things that really matter as much as I possibly can, which, it's the kids. They get the best of me. They have to get the best of me. You only have them for so long in your house. And as my 14-year-old told me this year, she's leaving in 4 years. I better make the most of it. So she's getting older, so I don't have that much more time with her in the house. So, I try to really focus on that lately as that has to come first. And taking better care of myself. I've really been focused in the last year about setting better boundaries with work, establishing systems where I'm not the go-to person all the time, better leadership in the company, in the practice, and doing better at advocating for myself when I have hit the point where I'm no longer feeling my best. With my husband, with my kids, with work, taking the time to really take care of myself more.
I recalling the conversation earlier around in year three, you recognized that things were kind of going off the rails with the business. Oh, I got to go back to school, right? In some ways, again, it was another investment of your time, money, and energy into something else that wasn't directly you. But of course, the payoff you hope is, well, if I get better at this, my business will be scalable. My business will be more sustainable. I will work less than 80 hours a week and be really, hopefully, less frustrated with the hours that I do put in. So it can feel like a step backwards to move forward. When you think about your personal life, can you think of where you've made that same kind of investment in trying to say, all right, I know it's taking more of me, but I know there's a payoff?
I think really I saw work this business in that light the whole time. I feel like I had a lot of pressure from the kids and my husband initially, like you're a workaholic, you're doing too much, do less, do less. And I really felt like I had to kind of stay true to myself that I knew if I put the time in now, the less will come. You can't get to that point without putting in the time and effort. And I see life often as phases. Right, I try to see things as phases where even with the kids, like I don't work too hard at addressing something sometimes if I know it's a phase, right? Why put Why read 10 books about this problem when I know in reality they're going to stop doing this in a month anyway? So I try to see things as phases, and there's ups, there's downs, and the downs go back up at some point, you know? And sometimes you're putting in more investment in the work part, sometimes more in the child rearing part. You know, there was points in my career I can think of when I first had my kids, I didn't care about work at all. My goal was to work as little as possible and be home as much as possible. And that was okay. And I had to sort of reinvent myself at various times through my parenting and my work career based on who needed me more. You know, when the kids went back to school, oh, I have more time. I can really focus again on my professional development. And that felt great. And then it went a little too far that direction, and I had to refocus myself on my kids that needed me more at home. So always riding that line, you know, of balance is a challenge I think we're all facing, and I think why you started the podcast, because that is surfing the quicksand in a nutshell, I would think.
It absolutely is. And you're right. I think it is this sense of not certainly not in the same way that you have. I'm not helping people walk. But it was important to me to say, how do I continue to bring content and energy and ideas and knowledge and inspiration to people who feel stuck and can't even look around to figure out exactly why they're stuck or how they're stuck, but they know they're feeling it. And so by being able to say like, nope, this is part of how I feel so desperately that I want to put this kind of positive energy and content in the world. And if it hits the right person at the right time, everybody wins as far as I'm concerned, right? It's part of that. But is it a ton of work? It absolutely is a ton of work. And I'm grateful to have the opportunity to do it and grateful for people like you to help me be good at it. I want to use that as an opportunity to switch to the quicksand three, which is the
Awesome.
three questions that I ask all of my guests and really kind of aligned with the principles of the surfing the quicksand. The first is, what's a technique or a trick that you use to help you get unstuck and do something you've been avoiding?
You know, I think that for me, it's not so much the things I'm avoiding, it's the overwhelm of all the things at one time. That's where I get stuck, is I don't know where to go, or I feel awful inside because I can't even focus on the next thing because there's a thousand things. So for me, my key is really writing things down so I can get them out of my head and onto a surface that I don't have to then be focused on remembering them. So I use my Google task list for everything. So I use the repeat task to make sure I don't forget to do the payroll and, you know, give the dogs medicine once a month, like all the stuff that would just clog up my brain. I get into a task on Google, and it's on my phone, it's on my computer. If I think of it in the car, I can quickly add it in. So that's my definitely my go-to for reducing the overwhelm that comes with living the lifestyle that I do
I
and
love
that
that.
stuck feeling.
I'm a list person. Same thing. I'm an iPhone person, so if I'm my notes app and like I don't know what I would do without that, right? And I've always been a to-do list person, and I've been a digital to-do list person for certainly 20 years, like since my BlackBerry. I love that it's just ingrained in how I get control over the things that are firing in my brain and keeping me up at night, right? For sure.
I've tried the pretty calendars. No, I've had so many beautiful written calendars that I have gotten through January 4th, and that's just trash. So I've given up. I don't buy any fancy calendars anymore. They do not work for me.
I talk to people about paper versus digital and what works for you, and if you're going to do paper, what does that need to be? Because I think a lot of people do struggle with it, and they are so desperate to say, I think a system, the right system, the right tool will help me feel like my life is in order. That's probably not the answer.
Yes,
Okay,
totally.
second question. If time and history, skills, ability, money, location, if none of those were a factor, what's a career or job you think you might have liked to try?
It's probably not that far-fetched as you might think, but I would have loved to be an EMT or an ER doctor. There's something about the excitement of, you know, trying to save a life. You know, I do well under pressure in those situations. I would have loved to do something fast-paced like that.
I love that. And I can see you being great at that. And not only in terms of your focus on patients, but again, that creativity and the problem solving just feels so aligned with that. Okay, third question. What is a way that you recharge or hit the reset button when life gets chaotic?
It's yoga for me. And different styles of yoga. It sometimes I need to go to hot, sweaty, work as hard as I can yoga, and that makes my brain quiet. My brain is loud all the time, right? So I need to quiet it down sometimes. And I sometimes working physically hard is the best way for me to do that. And sometimes it's like a yin yoga or just a stretching yoga where I can really just relax and feel that. Or sometimes really just a walk in the woods, like being outside with nature. Those are my go-tos.
I love it. And I know you have a new dog, and I'm sure there's a lot of walks that go along with having a new
Yes, he's
dog.
been so good for me. That didn't come up today. He's been like my caregiver. Everyone's joking that I was the one who was so against getting a golden retriever because of all the fur. I'm like, oh, it's slobbery, it stinks, it's fur. This dog has been so good for me because I stop work, I take a walk, I'm outside 5 times a day, 6 times a day. And of course, who does the dog stay with all the time? Me, the one who didn't want the dog. So he's my little buddy. He's my sidekick. He gets me outdoors. So that's the funny part of the family right now is, of course, he's just a mom's dog and one more octopus arm pulling on my arm all the time. But he's a good one, so
I love it.
I'll let him keep pulling.
I love it. I love it. Katie, thank you so much. This has really been a great conversation. And I think we got a lot of information, not only about how to think about our parents and their aging process and the kinds of resources that even exist, but also as caregivers, what are some things that we can do in our own lives to help be better in that process, to be a better witness and support, and just find the time to be put the care back in caregiving, really, for ourselves as well. I want to ask you to kind of share if somebody wants to get in touch with you, wants to learn more about your services, but also I know that, you're kind of East Coast, North Shore, East Coast, Massachusetts person, but one of the things is you have a really great newsletter that I don't read a lot of news. I don't subscribe to a lot of newsletters. I don't read a lot of newsletters, but when yours comes in, it gets read because I always find really important things in there. And so how can people find out about all of these?
Sure, I appreciate that. You can find me online. It's healthyagingpt.com. The blog's on there. I try to make the website really user-friendly and lots of information for free. So it's something that's beyond just what we offer, how to sign up. There's lots of information on there. There's videos on exercise with Parkinson's. There's just a whole host of information. I'm on Facebook, Healthy Aging PT, Instagram, Healthy Aging PT. I don't do any other social media because I don't understand it, don't want to deal with it. So you won't find me on TikTok, I can guarantee you that. The phone number for the office is 617-398-4508. That's the best way to get in touch. And then my email is Katie, KATIE, at healthyagingpt.com. And I invite anyone and everyone to reach out to me with questions, comments. You'll probably see me driving around town a lot in my car labeled with my business. So you can always flag me down too when you see me.
Thank you. And I have to do a plug for something that j literally just happened within the last 24 hours of us recording this in a local community Facebook group where somebody was asking, hey, does anybody know somebody who can help with at-home physical therapy? And comment after comment after comment. And then I chimed in. I said, is it too late for me to also add Katie from Healthy Aging, right? You have a big, big fan base that's purely related to what you've done for people in this community. And I hope you feel that love, and I hope you feel that you've earned it.
I do, and it gave me a tickle when I saw it today because I'm like, oh, everyone's just so sweet, and those are other PTs saying that too. Like, we're such a good collaborative community that there's people in that group that are other therapists, and I live, work, eat, breathe Wakefield. I'm here all the time. My kids are in school, so it's nice to be really feeling like I'm part of this community as a transplant. We moved here from somewhere else. I wasn't born and raised here, but I really feel like I'm pretty embedded here, and I've met wonderful people and in our extended neighborhoods too, of course. So it's a good place to be, and I'm happy people know who we are and keep spreading the word, and I really appreciate that.
Great. Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This was really helpful for me to think about, kind of again, always my own parents, my in-laws, thinking about the kinds of factors we're hearing around their bodies, around physical therapy, around what they can do, what they can't do, what they should do. I loved the conversation about the goals and being really clear on what's behind the goal, not just walking, but getting to the senior center to play poker, right? And recognizing that there might be other pathways to live the life that you need to. Physical therapy, occupational therapy, AIDS, all sorts of things can help get there. And that invitation to think a bit more creatively about how we help our loved ones to age with as much independence and dignity and joy as possible. I think this is always a great reminder. I hope you got a lot out of this conversation with Katie, whether, again, it's as a caregiver to aging parents or even thinking about yourself as your own body's creaking a bit more. And I encourage you to head over to her website and again to sign up for her newsletter. I think there's always great stuff in there and when I receive it, tips that again I can use for my parents, but also me. Thanks so much for being here.